everyone, and welcome to Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. I'm Kelly Guyett, a guest host for this episode with Candace Cuby and Becky Chris, who are going to be here to talk about their book, Speculative Pedagogies of Qualitative Inquiry. We're going to start off today by hearing a little from our two guests, Candace and Becky. So Candace, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for the invitation to join and share a little bit about our book. I'm Candace Cuby, and I'm currently a professor at the University of Missouri in the Department of Learning Teaching Curriculum, where I also serve as the department chair and the director of qualitative inquiry for our college. I'm excited to get to have this conversation with you and with Becky and to see what it might produce in the world.
Hi, everybody. I'm Becky Christ. Thank you for having us on the podcast to speak about our book and possibly some other things that we think about and we've worked on together. I am an assistant professor at Florida International University in Miami, Florida, and I'm in the Department of Teaching and Learning. I focus on social studies education, but I also have the great opportunity to teach qualitative courses here at the university at the graduate level. And prior to being in this position, I was at the University of Missouri with Candace, which is where we met and started working together.
Great. So the first question is kind of our standard qualitative interview question. If you could tell me a little bit about your book.
Well, I'll get us started on this one. So as Becky just mentioned, we met together while Becky was a doctoral student here and I was teaching classes. So I had her in a number of classes and co-chaired her dissertation committee. And in that time together, I began thinking about how we go about teaching qualitative inquiry, how we are preparing people to be inquirers within the academy and the world. And so this book came from a partnership that I think began back in 2015, where Becky served as a teaching and research assistant in a Qual 1 class that I was teaching. And so this book comes from a number of years of us having focus groups with students after the semester's concluded, not only about introductory qualitative research courses, but also advanced ones like a narrative inquiry class, a post-structural theory and methods class, as well as philosophical perspectives and educational research. And so that's really where the book came from. We wrote several book chapters and articles about our thinking, but felt like we needed a larger space to really explore just the teaching of inquiry. And is it even possible? We talked about that a lot. Can you teach someone to actually inquire? And so I would say that that's really what sparked the book and the exploration that we had in the book. Becky, other things you want to add?
I think that was a very good synopsis of our project together. I mean, I remember Candace first approaching me about this project. Well, before I knew it was a project, she asked me to go come to her office to speak with her. And I was a student in her course, or I had recently been a student in her course. So I was terrified that I might have done something wrong. And she surprised me with this wonderful opportunity to work with her. And I was just thrilled and super excited. And it helped me grow so much throughout my graduate program, the second half of my graduate program, but then also in becoming an early career scholar as well. So really grateful for that opportunity to work with her.
Yeah, and I'll add that I think the book is really kind of an ontological ethical exploration into inquiry. What is it? Is it possible to be taught, like I said before? And I think really because as scholars, Becky and I had been reading and were familiar with different post-structural or post-humanist humanist philosophies. And while it did inform our analysis and methodological practices kind of in our own research areas, so Becky in social studies education and myself in early literacies, it really was a prompting to think about, well, it should also inform our pedagogy and how does it get embodied or lived out in classroom spaces. And so I think that's how we came together jointly to really think about the teaching and learning of qualitative inquiry.
You just mentioned pedagogy. And so I was curious if you could talk a little bit about how you came to this idea of speculative pedagogies. Where did that come from? And then maybe tell us a little bit about how you take that up in the book.
When we started thinking about the book project as a whole, if I'm remembering correctly, and Candace, correct me if I'm wrong here, you had recently returned from a trip to South Africa And we had been, Candace and I had already been talking about how we might want to do a have a larger space for some of this work, because there was so much still left to interrogate and think with. And every time we wrote a piece, new things came up. And in fact, I remember reading through the proofs of this book and telling Candace that I was already ready to work on a second edition, because I wanted to, like, there was so much more that, you know, I wanted to think about and through with her and with the philosophies and the theories that we were thinking with already. But with that, going back to the South Africa trip, she was asked to do some, she was working, it was a workshop, I believe, with teacher educators and scholars there. And she had created this concept map, and a lot of things were showing up on it that we'd already thought through, but then also new things. And it, within the, you know, post-human and feminist and materialism concepts that we were thinking with, the idea of that material making an impact on what we were thinking about and through really kind of showed up in this map, for lack of a better term. And speculative was one of those words. And we ran with that. And we started then to get into a practice that we call re-etymologizing, where we're looking at the definition that shows up in the dictionary, as well as the origins and etymologies of words, and thinking through not just what those things mean, although possibly also that, but also what they can produce and what is beyond the meaning or meaning, and what else can we do with that word. And speculative was one of those words. Candace, I'm probably not doing very good justice to the story speculative. Feel free to jump in.
No, yeah. I mean, a lot of the origin of the book itself came from when I was teaching a course in South Africa, and we each had to choose a word. And I chose the word inquiry to think with that week, and was really this practice of forceful concept mapping, trying to put concepts together that you might not think go together. And so I really spent that week and beyond thinking about that notion of inquiry. And like Becky said, speculative somehow made it there. And I think it was really informed, like Becky said, with some of the scholars we were thinking and reading with, who talk about speculative practices in the world. And so that really, I think, is what launched it into the title eventually.
Thank you. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we actually have a fourth member of our group today. So Seth McCall is joining us, and while I think he was hoping to be behind the scenes, we're gonna bring him into this conversation, because he has some really wonderful questions for Candace and Becky. So Seth, I'm gonna turn things over to you.
Yeah, I was interested in hearing about your past experiences teaching qualitative research, and how this approach that you discuss in the book might differ from what we might consider traditional approaches to teaching qualitative research, and what are some of the reasons that you go in that different direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great question. I think I mentioned earlier that really, you know, being immersed in different post-philosophical scholars and readings really prompted my thinking in early literacies research around methodology, but also pedagogies with young children. And so as I was finding myself teaching qual classes in higher education, I was really curious to see what would it look like or feel like to think about that in relation to adults learning how to be qualitative inquirers, you know, in the world and in the academy. And so I think for myself and Becky, we could probably list out a handful of philosophical concepts that really impacted how we thought about pedagogical moves and decisions, all the way from how the syllabus was created, our invitations that we would give students each week in class. I would say a lot that we write about is around time and space and matter, and how matter matters, and what comes to be in a classroom space, and matter as, you know, textbooks, the tables, the art materials that we might bring in. And, you know, students would say to me, I haven't touched a glue stick since elementary school, and you're asking me to create in a doctoral class with theories I'm reading about and field notes and transcripts, et cetera. So I think that pedagogically, those are practices that Becky and I both, you know, introduce in our teaching. I think for me, more kind of broadly speaking, as an instructor, I was noticing how our introductory qual sequence was set up at Mizzou. And Qual 1 is often talked about as, you know, write a research question, do a lit review, try out an interview with someone, try out some field notes. And then when they got to Qual 2, if students took Qual 2, because it's not required, then we'll get into some analysis. And so for me, I think these philosophies also, since they resist binary logics in the world, really forced us to think about how the academy, especially the teaching of our research classes, are often set up and perpetuating binary logics of like method is separate from theory. So they might take a class on theories, they might take a class on research methods. And then we might have one class that's kind of like the pre the data collection, and then a whole nother class is set aside for analysis. And so all of these kind of separations and binaries didn't work with the philosophical ideas that we were thinking about. And so I think, I mean, those I would say are some of the big ideas that influenced our exploration and thinking as well as teaching together. And I think the last that I'll comment on, and then I'd love to hear Becky's thoughts, would just be how these philosophies really focus on relationships and what gets produced in relationships of humans and more than humans in the world. And so I think that notion of ethico-onto epistemology, or how knowing, being, and doing in the world cannot be separate, was really critical in how we think about setting up, you know, a course, a syllabus, course expectations, and what we invite students to think and do over the course of the semester.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of everything that Candace said here. And I think I come from an interesting perspective because I was a graduate student the first time I taught this course, essentially. I wasn't the instructor of record by any means, but I was in the course with Candace and I was helping have those discussions about what pedagogy could look like and what kinds of things we might want to do differently than the so-called traditional research courses that I had been in as a student. So I had this interesting perspective of being a student, but also being in this role as instructor at the time, but it's definitely influenced how I continue to teach qual courses, because those experiences coming from the theories and the philosophies that we were reading. I think it was Betty St. Pierre that said something along the lines of theory produces people. And so we were kind of doing all of this reading and we were thinking, how can we not now take this into our pedagogy? It is producing this new and different way of looking at the world, and that impacts how we enter into spaces and how we enter and interact with other beings, humans and non-humans, more than humans. The other thing I wanted to bring up that in reference to Candace bringing up the binaries issue, this idea that there is a traditional and a non-traditional, or a traditional and a disruptive, is something that Candace and I have talked a lot about in both the planning, during the class, following, writing our research up after the fact. And I think we still wrestle with that. But we kind of approach this of, why can't it be a both and? Why can't we not bring all of those things into the classroom and have the students kind of wade through that, navigate, negotiate these spaces in new ways, and kind of, for lack of a better term, figure out where they're at for right now and where they might go in the future as they continue to develop as students and as scholars. I mean, we're all still developing as scholars. This is not a one and done deal. We're continuously learning and living in the world. And so I think that that's really important that we really tried to bring in kind of the both and there. And it was not always easy. It was very messy sometimes, and it was sometimes confusing and frustrating to students. In fact, they told us so. One of our students said something like, I was frustrated all the time, but it was a good frustration. And Candace and I thought, what does it mean to be have a good frustration? But we understood, I think we understood what she meant by that, because it produces something different than having one and then the other, but both of them together in inter and interaction, it produces something new for everybody in the room.
So hearing you talk about the both and, one thing I really appreciated about your book was the way that it dwells in and takes seriously qualitative pedagogy. So this isn't something that we often see scholars in our field really doing. I think there are people doing it, and certainly Candace, I've seen some of your work, you know, you take this up seriously. And so I know, you know, for me, I was really lucky to come to a program that encouraged me to think about the teaching of qualitative research in addition to the doing of qualitative research. So I just was curious if y'all wanted to, I'm going off script a little bit here, but if y'all wanted to talk a little bit about how you approach those both ands in your teaching. You know, how do you engage students in the doing of qualitative inquiry while you also are preparing them to maybe one day also be teachers of qualitative research?
Such a great question, Kelly. I think part of it goes to just how the course is set up. I mean, I think I was surprised, Becky probably was too, how many times students talked to us in the focus group about my syllabus. I was a bit shocked about it. I mean, it's just like this document we all have to write, and you know, everybody has one for a course they teach. And I think it goes back to what Becky was saying about creating it as a both and. So it goes back to the text that we choose. Like, that seems like a simple thing in some regard as the course textbooks or readings, but we were really intentional about having kind of the both and. So really books that might be seen as disruptive to traditional, but then also very standard kind of qualitative textbooks, and not reading like one first and then the other, but putting chapters together each week from both that intentionally rub up against one another. And so I say that, but I say that to say that I think it was also the discourse and what got said in the class layered on top of these materials that really produced a space for students to think about not only their doing of inquiry, but also their thinking ahead to future jobs they might have and if they are instructors. And so I think a lot of the, help me, Becky, some of the phrases that students would just say over and over is, Candace, when we'd ask you stuff, it's always, it depends, or give yourself permission. It was a phrase that I used a lot, and Becky probably remembers more of them because she had me in classes. But, you know, I think it is that both and. It's both the materiality and the discursive moves that you make in a space that helps them see what was intentional that we did as instructors that at first they might not realize, because sometimes students would say like, I didn't even get that that's what you were doing by putting those books together, but oh, now I see why you did it and what it's producing. So I think it's being just really transparent and telling students like, this is why I set the class up this way. How did it work for you? What did that produce? Help me to learn, you know, in the next class that I teach, what I might do differently. So those are my initial thoughts to the question. Becky, what are you thinking about when you heard Kelly ask that?
I mean, so many things, but I think related to something you just said about the it depends, you know, that's kind of my standard answer now as well. You know, my students joke that they should get t-shirts that say it depends and just use them in class every time they come to class. But I think that that's key in fostering a space where students are thinking through every step of the research process, which begins before like any data is collected and continues far after that as well. There are ethical and political decisions that need to be made at every step. And for me, something that I've, you know, learned from Candace and then taking into my own practice as an instructor, as a professor, is that I don't want my students to just rely on proceduralism and fall back into that without knowing why they're making those decisions. And so I stress those conversations and those discussions in class, and I set up these spaces for them to interact and interact with each other and with materials to foster that space of it depends. And it's okay to be uncertain. But the goal is to think through those things and continuously think through those things. And, you know, for example, I engaged in a practice a couple weeks ago in class where I gave different groups. I have the students all submit reading responses each week so that I kind of get an idea for what they're thinking through. And then I usually compile those into some kind of discussion prompt document. Well, this time I gave each group different prompts and I put those prompts on a piece of paper. And then I asked them to concept map with it. And I gave them some markers and, you know, some tape. And then we added quotes over time and they went through this practice discussing with each other, working with the materials. And then we debriefed afterwards and I asked them, you know, what did this produce for you? Because I had some things in mind as an instructor, as a teacher, But we also know, and my work with Candace has shown this, and in the book too, that our pedagogies are always uncertain. We might have some things in mind, some hopes, but we also have to be ready for the unpredicted. And that's something that's really, really powerful. And for me, so those students, in responding to like, what did this produce for them? Or why would I have them engage in this kind of practice? They came back with a few responses that I was expecting and many more that I was not expecting that were in fact better than the ones that I expected in the first place. And I think that it's leaning into that uncertainty has been really key for me as an instructor, but it's not always easy to do, especially in the confines of particular universities, institutions, those kinds of things. And the syllabus is one of those examples. We all have to have a syllabus, but how do we construct a syllabus that is both smooth and striated, to use a Deleuzian set of concepts? And Candace and I have continuously thought through that, and I think we'll continue to think through that as we continue to teach.
I was really drawn to the way that the idea of uncertainty was just kind of brought forth in the book relative to pedagogy. And there was another concept that you threaded throughout the text, and I was just curious if you could tell us a little bit more about it. It's this notion of inquiry. And since we have people listening, it's difficult, we'd have to kind of explain the way that you write it in the book is a little different. So you have IN within parentheses, and then query, Q-U-E-R-Y. And so maybe you could walk us a little through why you use the term in that way, visually, you know, physically, why you write it like that, and what that means to you with regard to this work that you're doing.
Could I jump in here?
Yeah, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about re-etymologizing that you talked earlier and how we got to the spelling that Kelly just shared. And then I'd be happy to move us forward with the kind of four concepts that we use to define it.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, and I don't know that I'll do complete justice here. So Candace, you can fill in any place that I miss. But I think, so first of all, I think it's important to note that we use punctuation and, you know, parentheses and dashes and slashes very purposefully to try to have it have our writing produce something different, and to play with the words, to be very playful with that, but also to kind of force ourselves, Candace and I, as we're writing, but also hopefully the reader, to slow down and consider what they're reading and what the different meanings that could come from what they're reading, you know, could be and what it could produce for them. So that's one reason why we use a lot of parentheses and slashes and dashes that can be a little bit intimidating for some folks, I can imagine, or confusing. But that's why we do that. And I think that I remember the first time that we looked up the word inquiry, and I remember very vividly that Candace was like, wait, it's a noun? Like, how can inquiry be just a noun? Like, how is it a thing as opposed to a verb? And so it, and we had other conversations about do things, you know, verbs and nouns, or words that we thought should be one or the other, or that we used as one or the other, and maybe we're both and, as opposed to whatever the dictionary designated them to be. So so inquiry became one of those words. And so we wanted to think through inquiry as a doing, as well as a thing, a do thing. And so we looked up the, you know, the word inquiry, and then through our re-etymologizing, which is where we're looking up the definitions and the etymologies and playing with the meanings of the word to kind of open up something new. And we wanted to separate the in from the query, because the query is the seeking. And so we focused on that to kind of remind ourselves throughout the book, and hopefully to remind the readers that this is an active process. This is not a stable, stationary item that you could pick up and take up. this is an active, fluid, changing process. And that's one of the reasons why we chose to write it as such throughout the book.
Yeah, and just to add on, so as we were exploring inquiry kind of in that in a different way, and through the large concept map that I had started in South Africa and that had been added to year after year around the notion of inquiry, we came to try to conceptualize this notion of inquiry spelled in that way And there are four, I would say, concepts that we thread throughout the book. And so we define inquiry in this way as uncertain, which we've talked about a little bit, restful, but using the W-R-E-S-T and the R-E-S-T definition with some, you know, parentheses around certain letters, and also full, so F-U-L-L, so restful. There's lots of meanings going on there. Relational and liveliness. So inquiry to us is uncertain, restful, relational, and liveliness. And so those four concepts really shaped how we think about, one, the doing of inquiry, but then also our pedagogies of inquiry. And we spend a lot of time in the book then really trying to think through those. And we have three main chapters that we explore this notion of uncertain, restful, relational liveliness. And one is around trust and trusting. One is around navigating and negotiating in the academy. And one is around intervening. And so those are kind of the three big chapters that we use focus group conversations and things that happen in the courses to really dig a little bit deeper.
And I think we asked the question, like, how would we approach inquiry if we thought of it was alive? You know, like thinking about the liveliness, how could we do inquiry differently if it is lively, for example?
So one of the other concepts that you develop in the book is based on the idea of a rabbit hole and rabbit holing. And I was interested to hear more about how you came to that concept and what you do with it.
I love this question. I love that you gave it to us ahead of time to think about, because Becky might remember better of where rabbit holing came from. But I think broadly speaking, I think as scholars and writers and thinkers, whether we're writing an article, a book chapter, a book, there's often things that kind of get left on the drawing room floor where you don't feel like it fits into the structure of the book that you've created. But yet you feel like it's really important in how the book or the piece came to be. And often with word limits, you just cut it. And so for us, as we were really beginning to write the book, kind of that notion of inquiry is uncertain, relational, restful liveliness. And we had kind of these three main chapters that I just talked about. We had these other things that were produced that we weren't sure what to do with them, but we kept coming back to them in our thinking and we kept talking about them, but they didn't need like a full chapter. And so we decided to thread the rabbit holes throughout the book as sort of interludes in a way, but also both of us as writers wanted the book to feel alive and to be quite interactional for people. And so these interludes and these rabbit holes often have invitations, spaces in the pages for people to write and to draw, questions for readers to ponder. And so that's my understanding of how they came to be and how they served kind of purposes for us as thinkers and writers, but also what we hope they would do in the world as people read the book.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what Candace was saying. And I think that an additional aspect that maybe, again, the uncertainty and the liveliness of the rabbit holing coming to be is we might have thought it was going to be one thing. And then as we continue to go down the rabbit hole to burrow with each other and the philosophies and the theories and etymologies and definitions of words, we came to, see new things, to produce new ideas. And that, and interestingly, a lot of the rabbit holes, like Candace said, originated from one chapter that didn't quite fit, so we would pull it out and think with it otherwise. But there were other times where, you know, later chapters would also return back to the rabbit hole. I think one of the problems that, you know, I have, and Candace and I have talked about this with, a lot of academic writing, is that it happens in two-dimensional texts on paper. And that it necessitates a linear process in a sense. And so how do we play with that linear process? We decided to include these rabbit holes that kind of connect in various ways. It's kind of like an assemblage does. It has all these rhizomatic elements to it throughout the text. And the other piece that I really like about the rabbit holes and in the chapters is that we had the great honor of having several artists, friends, scholars contribute their art to our text as a way to bring the visual more, a little bit more in. Of course, it's still limited, right? Because it's in printing and those kinds of things. But we wanted to have not just text, in a sense. We wanted to have some of that visual. So we have some wonderful art throughout the book that is not our original work, but was provided to us by some amazing artist scholars.
And then I was also wondering if you'd be comfortable sharing some of your most recent rabbit holes that you've been going down.
Oh, that is such a good question. do you mean individually or collectively?
Both and. Either.
Okay, both and, yes. while I was preparing the syllabus for a new course that I was going to teach, I went on my own rabbit hole, down my own rabbit hole on the idea of a syllabus and what it can produce for students. And so I'm hoping to take, you know, to be able to work more on that here soon. And I think I texted Candace, I was of course writing late at night, you know, the night before, before the class is supposed to finish, to try to put these finishing touches on it. And I went down this complete rabbit hole instead of doing what I was quote unquote supposed to be doing. And I think I texted Candace, like, Candace, we need to talk more about syllabi again. That was one for me.
Yeah. This too is a really, thought-provoking question. And I think for me, I have found myself thinking more kind of about these three main chapters of the book and wanting to think more about the notion of trust and trusting and pedagogies, as well as the navigating and negotiating that happens in the relationships of teacher-student, but also within the academy at a macro level, but also the micro kind of institutional levels. And so I think my thinking has just continued to sort of go down that rabbit hole. And then the notion of intervening, I've written about elsewhere with a collaborator that I have in early literacies. And we just are really trying to rethink this notion of intervene that often gets talked about in educational discourse. I think of it often used sort of from a deficit perspective, or as the adult having all the knowledge, or the teacher and the student or the child or the learner is, you know, doesn't have. And so trying to kind of disrupt how we think about intervening and really rethink it through a more kind of ethical onto epistemological view of the world and how we come to be in relationships. And so I think for me, those are kind of some of the places that I found myself thinking and writing more around that were really kind of prompted from the book that we co-authored together. And I would say we have some other overlapping partnerships with two other authors right now, just around the notion of blind review. What does it mean to be blinded in review? And we've done some fun etymologizing in that piece too about, is it possible to be blinded in review? And so I think we're thinking also with others, not just in the partnerships of the two of us that are taking us down some new rabbit holes.
And then the last one, last question I have is how something like rabbit holing might inform the way you approach pedagogy or qualitative research.
I mean, I can share that once I went down the rabbit hole and I wrote a short little piece, I actually shared it with my students in the first class to kind of open up this space to talk about uncertainty and liveliness and how these things can kind of happen when we least expect them. And also to let them in a little bit more on my teaching philosophy and what kinds of things they might be engaging with in the course, because it was a course on the histories and philosophies of educational research, essentially. It was an advanced seminar that I was teaching for the first time. And so I utilized that in class, actually. So that was a really fun process to let students in on that and then invite them, you know, give themselves permission, as Candace might say, to engage in that kind of activity throughout the semester as we were reading and engaging with different texts and media and things throughout the course.
Yeah, this is such a good question that I don't know I have an answer for. It's really prompted me to think a little bit more. I don't know that I've been explicit in classes since the book was published, and perhaps just because I'm in an administrative role and I'm not getting to teach as much as I once did, about being transparent about this notion of rabbit holing and what it might produce for us as learners in a particular class, but also in students, you know, research kind of projects or inquiries that they have. So I would be excited to hear or think about how listeners who listen to the podcast, you know, might think about this notion of rabbit holing. And what that might produce for our teaching, but also I would say for our own inquiries in the world. I think it does open up and give permission for things to be kind of untamed or experimental or creative or innovative. And I think perhaps sometimes the way we think about qual research and the teaching of it, it becomes more formulaic or scripted or kind of rigid in steps. And so I think the notion of rabbit holing might be a fun thing for us to think about as a community.
Well, I just wanted to say, Becky, since you brought it up, I was just so drawn to the visual elements of the book. I think that was such a thoughtful and just aesthetically lovely decision that you both made. So it's just, I can't go, you know, in the podcast without saying that the images that you included not only helped me understand the types of things you're writing about, but it just gave me another entry point into this work. So I just wanted to thank you for you know, integrating those into the text. And I have one final question that I thought I would pose to you two. And, you know, before we kind of got started with the podcast, Becky and I were talking about time and the fact that this book came out early part of 2020, late 2019, and the class you initially taught together was years ago in 2014. And I was curious how the inquiries and the thinking in the book have lingered with you since the time of writing it. And maybe a two-part to this question, second part to the question, what are speculative pedagogies still doing with and for you?
Well, I'd love to start just with the first paragraph of the book. And because I think it goes to kind of your first question, maybe, Kelly. So we write in our acknowledgments, actually, a quote from Aaron Manning and Brian Masumi. And the quote is, "When skulls bump, the resulting brainwave interference patterns can be a revelation to both." And so I think, you know, what we're trying to say here as we go on to write is that we are energized, we become anew, we create, we think, we write, and we teach when our skulls bump. We love our skulls bumping. We can't imagine life without them bumping. It is life-giving and sustaining. So I think even though the teaching happened, you know, 2014, 15, 16, 17, and the writing of the book came to be, you know, around 2019 and 20. I think even if we're physically not in the same place anymore, that our skulls are still bumping and we love that. And so I think that it's so generative to be okay with not knowing what will happen when that happens, and to really just pick up in different, you know, different times and different places and think together. And some of our articles that have come out even since the book, I think, is really reflective of that.
Candace, I think it's really interesting that you went to the beginning of the book, and I was actually thinking of the end of the book. but I love how our skulls bump throughout the entire thing. And sometimes when things seem divergent, there's also a bumping that is happening. I think that's really important to think through. Because I was thinking about, and I apologize, Kelly, I'm not entirely sure that this is going to answer your question directly, but maybe an indirect response is okay. I was thinking about how in the conclusion of our text, we were actually a little bit stuck, maybe is the right word, and what we wanted to say not necessarily what was the point, because all of this is the point, but what do we want to kind of leave the reader with? And we were stuck on that. We weren't really sure how we wanted to end. And so we ended up going back to material thinking with, in addition to the philosophical and theoretical thinking with that we were always already doing. And I had taken pieces of our book chapters thus far, and I had started to cut them up and place them together and, apart and differently and with other materials. And all of a sudden I looked down and there was this layering of these circles of text. So you could read the previous text almost, in line with the new text, but it was a new thought entirely. And that became kind of our ending, near the very end of the book. And what we kind of cleaned it up a little bit, but it says, an ethics of always already ing is about the in-betweenness. The always already more ing, this theory, ever provoking, working together, inquiry deuced our thinking with, a living speculative qualitative inquiry happening in between, in the moment, bit by writing. We are, have been ruined, and for me, kind of the way that I've continued to take up this book beyond, along with the four concepts that we've already talked about and the notions of inquiry, is that this, the ing, right? We're never really sure what the ing is. What is going to happen? What is happening? What it is producing? But that kind of productive unknowing can be really generative in classroom spaces, especially when our classroom spaces, PK through higher ed, are becoming more and more standardized, routinized. And so to have this space for the ing, to be uncertain of what could happen, I think is something that I've continued to take with me, not just in my pedagogies, but also, in the way I live my life, which has been a really beautiful part of my relationship working with Candace, is that it's not just academic, it's not just research, it is research, and it is academic, and living in the world is part of that.
Well, I think that generativity that you're alluding to comes forth so beautifully in the text, and certainly in all of the things you two co-write. And back to Candace bringing up this idea of trust, I think it's such a beautiful concept that you play with here, and it really springs forth in the book, not only the trust that occurs between you and the students, both of you and the students, but the trust that happens amongst the two of you. And trust is an active, a verb, a thing that continues to occur. So I just appreciate it so lovely that you unplanned went both to the front of the text and the back of the text to respond to that question. And it's funny, I was flipping through the book before our talk today, and Becky, that last image is one that just really struck me. And I just thought it was such a beautiful kind of representation of the complexity of the teaching and the doing of inquiry that you both engage in. So thank you very, very much for taking the time to chat today and for inviting me to be part of this. And Seth, thank you for your support and your organization of herding cats, trying to get this to happen. But I guess this concludes our talk today. And again, thank you. And we'll wrap things up.
Well, thanks to you both for the invitation to be a part of the podcast series. And Becky, it was lovely just to have this chat a couple of years after the book went out in the world.
Yeah, thank you so much. I was also saying that it was really nice to return to the book and kind of view it in new and different ways as well. So thank you for that opportunity and to speak with you all.